Welcome to Good Dog, a podcast all about our four-legged friends who accompany us through life asking only for food, a good walk, and some love. So simple. Today we'll be talking about dog emotions, their capacity for joy and sadness, fear and despair, love and hate. My guest is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder and co-founder with Jane Goodall of Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Mark's the author or editor of more than 200 articles and numerous books, including the Encyclopedia of Animal Behavior and most recently, The Emotional Lives of Animals. Mark, welcome to Good Dog.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, anybody who knows dogs knows that they experience joy, sorrow, and empathy. Is this or was this at one time a radical concept?
Yes, very much so. You know, up until perhaps the last 5 or 10 years, there still were colleagues of mine who would wonder whether or not animals such as dogs had emotions. And when they do, I always said, I'm glad I'm not their dog. My goodness gracious, wouldn't that just be terrible?
It's hard to imagine because clearly they were observing animals, right, and spending time with animals?
Well, yeah, they were. But, you know, it's just kind of interesting. In my book, I tell a story about my colleague named, I'll call him Bill, and his dog named Reno. And when I went to give a talk at the university where Bill taught, he ran up and said, "Hi, Mark, how are you?" Told me all about Reno, who I'd met before, and told me Reno loved to walk, was jealous of when he gave attention to his daughter. When Bill would leave him alone, he would get really upset and would, you know, tear his house apart, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought, well, you know, that's fascinating. So I gave my talk on animal emotions. And no sooner did I finish, but Bill's hand went right up into the air and said, "Well, Mark, you know, you're just being anthropomorphic. You don't know all of this." And so I took a deep breath, and I said, "Bill, would you like to tell the audience about Reno?" And he went, "Oh, well, you know what I mean." And I went, "No, I don't know what you mean." And so what happened from that conversation was very interesting. It developed into this thing that I've been writing about. The first question is, why is a dog at home different from a dog in a laboratory? And the other question I ask researchers is, would you do it to your dog? And what I mean there is, would you do it to your dog, meaning if you treat animals cruelly and you won't do it to your dog, then why do you do that? So dogs have figured into my life, you know, centrally. I've lived with dogs forever, and I just love watching their emotions.
It's interesting. I think part of it is that we just have this ability as people, I don't know, maybe we're the only species who do this, to compartmentalize.
Right. One of the reasons people don't face up to the fact of what they do, and you know, especially to our best friends like dogs, is they compartmentalize. We're masters at denial. And so what I try to do in my work is to push and push the hard questions, to ask the hard questions, and to have researchers, you know, if you will, fess up. I mean, there's no logical reason why a dog at home is different from a dog in a lab, or, you know, there's no different reason why my dog, I might treat my dog differently than I treat your dog. And so we are very good at doing that, and animals generally don't do that. They don't need to do it.
Right. They're maybe higher up the evolutionary chain in some ways than we are.
In some ways.
Well, knowing something intuitively is one thing, but you've actually been able to scientifically prove that animals have emotions, right?
Right. I've done a lot of work, and my colleagues have done a lot of work. I am a cognitive ethologist. That's what I call myself, which means I study animal minds. And one of the things I've studied forever is animal play behavior. And by watching dogs and wolves and coyotes play, for example, I've noticed, you know, not only do they enjoy what they do, but they also have rules of conduct. They know right and wrong. They act morally. There's an ethic that drives them when they play. And along with that, I've got colleagues who have studied elephants to show that elephants grieve their dead. They provide care to other elephants who need it. When I was in Africa last year, I watched a group of elephants care for a female named Babel who had been injured when she was young. And Babel could do nothing for the group, But they waited for her and they fed her. And, you know, some of my scientist friends would say, well, no, no, animals never do something for which they don't get a payback. You know, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. But the fact of the matter is there was nothing Babel could do. She was injured. She walked at a very slow pace, and often she couldn't feed. So it's those kinds of situations, you know, that I've observed and my colleagues have observed that shows without a doubt that other animals have emotions.
So do the males and females nurture equally in a situation like that?
Yes, they did. Yeah, they just had nothing to... there was just no sex or gender differences. Yeah, they just took care of her because she was a friend.
Fascinating. When you mentioned a moment ago that you've observed rules of play and that animals have, or dogs have, a kind of morality, can you give me some examples of that?
Yeah, for example, when dogs play, they use actions from a whole lot of other contexts. You know, they bite one another, they'll mount one another, they'll hip slam one another. And so if you didn't know they were playing, it could look like they were trying to eat one another, like a predator would eat a prey. They were trying to mate with one another, or they were trying to dominate one another. So somehow they have to know that they're playing. And what we've discovered in dogs is that a very familiar signal that we call the play bow, when the animal bows on the forepaws and puts their butt up in the air and wags their tail and sometimes barks, this play bow is used not only to say, I want to play with you, but they punctuate play sequences, and they use the play bow when it's likely that an action can be misinterpreted. So, for example, if I'm playing with you and I'm going to bite you hard, I may precede the bite with a play bow as if to say, excuse me, I'm going to bite you, but don't take it as, say, aggression. And likewise, after I bite you, you might look at me and go, wait a minute, that was a hard bite. We're playing. And I might do a play bow right after I bite you as if to say, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I apologize. And a lot of people go, oh, you're just being anthropomorphic, nothing like this ever happens. But the fact of the matter, it does happen. We have good scientific data to show, especially when animals are playing, that they do have rules of social conduct that they know right from wrong, that they can be moral beings.
Are they taught this, or is this something that comes instinctually?
Well, it's probably a combination, but I think they learn it through the reinforcement that they get from other dogs, or, you know, if it's coyotes or wolves, like we would get it in the playground. I remember when I was growing up, and I'm sure, you know, all your listeners remember, you'd be playing with a friend, and maybe you'd push them too hard, or you might slam into them too hard. And they'd look at you, you know, saying, basically, if you want to play, you can't do that. And I think dogs learn that they can't bite too hard, they can't slam their body into another dog too hard, or else play will stop. And that's what I find fascinating, that they do learn, and they learn very fast. We discovered in coyotes that coyotes who play unfairly can't get other coyotes to play with them. And so, you know, it's the same kind of, I guess you'd call it social reinforcement that they get when the same type of social reinforcement they get as we get when we're playing, say, in the school ground.
It's absolutely fascinating. And so much of what you describe reminds me of children.
Yes. I've always been amazed at how many child psychologists have been very interested in the work that I've done on the development of behavior and the development of, say, social rules in dogs, because kids do the same. Human children do exactly the same.
You write about the emotional lives of animals. What are emotions as differentiated from feelings?
Well, you know, once again, scientists play a lot of word games. I like to think of emotions as what I would call like a psychoneural event. There's a psychological component that we feel, but there's also the neural event. Something's happening in our nervous system, where feelings just tend to be what we feel, the mood we're in or something like that. I often have a difficult time differentiating the two, but I think I think the emotion is the event. Something is happening that moves us in a certain way. And then you've got that feeling that accompanies the particular emotion.
So to understand this better, for instance, something like grief, where it actually has a physical component in addition to a feeling, would be more of an emotion?
Well, yes, I think grief would be the emotion. And then there's the feeling that we have that we don't feel right, something's wrong, and then we do something about it. Like, I may be grieving along with you the loss of a friend, and then I basically move to you to, if you will, you know, basically console you, or we console one another. So the feeling, to me, is sort of the psychological event that accompanies the neural event.
Right, so maybe sadness would be the feeling.
Yes.
But it might not be, right? When one is grieving, you can feel other things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you could feel a lot of remorse. I mean, I suppose some people, people for sure, but, you know, some animals might, they might not have any feeling, you know, they might just feel very neutral about the loss of a friend, and I suppose some could just be happy that they're gone, you know.
Relief.
Relief. No more, you know, no more being beat up by a certain other animal.
Right.
I know when my dog Jethro died, he's got a buddy Zeke, and Zeke still comes to my house now, 5 years after Jethro's died. And I don't think, you know, Zeke is a great dog. But, you know, I kind of got the feeling that after Jethro died and he disappeared, I don't know that, you know, Zeke knew that Jethro had died as we might know. Zeke felt relieved. He's really a people dog. So I don't say that, you know, in any mean-spirited way about Zeke. It's more, I actually do believe that Zeke just felt relieved. He didn't have to share the kennel anymore with Jethro.
You know, we've had a couple different experiences in our home with this. A number of years ago, we had a dog, Ziggy, and he was 16, and it was time. You know, he had tons of problems. And 6 months earlier, or a couple years earlier, we had gotten a puppy who had, you know, grown up for the previous couple years with him, Farfel. And when Ziggy died, Farfel was absolutely grieving. There was no question about it. He was depressed, despondent for a week. And then he came out of it, and he was fine. So now flash forward another 13 years, and we had done the same thing. For the last couple years of Farfel's life, we got a puppy, Lulu. And she really almost thought he was her mother, I think. You know, he taught her the ropes, and so we thought the same thing would happen, and we put Farfel to sleep really not that long ago, maybe a month or two ago, and we didn't notice her being all that sad at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think just like in people, you know, we kind of see in animals the same nuances. So, you know, for example, sometimes in a group of elephants, when an elephant dies, some really grieve. They go over, they touch the elephant, they hang out. They won't leave the elephant forever. And in other ways, other elephants just ignore the corpse. So I think a lot has to do with the social relationship between the animals. So, for example, the ASPCA has booklets about how to handle a dog who's grieving because he or she lost a best friend, either a best human friend or a best dog friend. So,
how should one deal with that?
Well, you know, I can't say. I'm not a dog psychologist, but one of the ways that I've dealt with it since I've lived with dogs is I've always had two dogs, and so, you know, that's really different. But when I had two dogs and then one of the dogs died or knew the dog was dying, then we kind of just gave a lot of attention to the survivor, if you will.
That's what we did, too.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. But I was living with a dog named Sasha and a dog named Inuk. And Inuk was dying, and Sasha really was a social dog. She loved dogs and she loved people. So I finally rescued a dog, this Jethro, to basically, if you will, you know, to live with Sasha and Inuk just didn't like the young dog at all. He was an old dog. He wasn't crotchety, but, you know, he just was kind of on his way out and really didn't appreciate the energy, if you will.
Who needs a puppy in later life, right?
Puppy around. But it was a great transition for all of them. Jethro learned, if you will, to ignore Inuk, and he and Sasha bonded and became really good friends. So I don't know, but I generally think that if you get another dog, you got to make sure that it's for the dog who's surviving, not the person. A lot of people go, well, I need a new dog now because, you know, so-and-so's dying and I need another dog, I need two dogs. But I've always been careful to say, well, let's assess the needs. So after Jethro died, Zeke doesn't live here. My friend Pam brings him every day. And I decided, well, I travel a lot. I've had enough of a dog fixed for a while. I was grieving Jethro. And, you know, Zeke was great. And a few years later, Pam got another dog named Maddie, and they're fine. But really, when I look at Zeke now, you know, 5 years after Jethro died, he seems to be the happiest when he's here alone or alone with me. So, you know, what's fascinating about your question is also something I write about, is just the unique personalities that arise in dogs, you know, the unique personalities they have. Some dogs are really needy and very dependent on others, whereas some dogs are just very independent. And you see the whole array of personalities and emotions in dogs, as you see in people.
Which is why, to me, it's so obvious that dogs have emotions.
Exactly.
Why, you know, they say dog is man's best friend. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think they say that because we have such a unique and strong bond with dogs. You know, evolutionarily, we domesticated wolves, we got dogs, and we have this very, very strong tie, and it's reciprocal. Some people, there's an author, Steve Budiansky, who thinks that dogs are always yanking our chains, and they're using us. And I couldn't disagree more with him.
He's a cat person, right?
Well, I don't know that he's an animal person. Number one, he certainly has never studied animals, but he feels free to write about them. And number two, maybe he is a cat person. But people ask me this question all the time, Joanne. And my only response is that they're man's best friend. They're people's best friend. But that's because of the long history. But I know dogs, and I'm sure you do too, who have not been treated well by people, and they're not people's best friends. So I'm very cautious when people go, oh, dogs are man's best friend, and they're unconditional lovers. They give us unconditional love. Well, sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. But I know dogs who have been abused or who have had bad experiences, and they're very wary of humans, and they don't just, you know, spill their love out to just any human.
So a dog will spill his or her love to you if it's reciprocal, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, so we like to think about that. There's a book called Dogs Never Lie About Love. Well, first of all, that's probably true to some extent. But once again, when dogs have that really nurturing and reciprocal and symmetrical relationship with people, there's no reason for them to lie about love.
Do dogs lie about anything?
You know what? Very rarely. You know, in play, getting back to that moral sense, people will go, oh, I've seen play escalate into aggression. Dogs cheat all the time. The fact of the matter is they don't cheat all the time. We tend to remember rare events, but I've studied this, and dog play only escalates into aggression a very small fraction of the time. You can watch thousands of interactions among dogs and even wolves and coyotes and foxes and never see them cheat in play. So dogs are pretty honest, as are most animals. You know, they don't have time to waste. Certainly, you know, people have studied deception in animals, but it's rare. Mainly because an animal who has been characterized as a cheater or a deceiver will have a lot of trouble getting other animals to interact with him.
Do animals tend to sense, or dogs, let's talk specifically about dogs, right off the bat when when another dog is going to be a friend or is going to be a good playmate for them, or are they just open to anybody?
I think they sense it pretty well. I think they sense the body language, the way the animal, the way the other dog is moving. They probably sense odors because dogs, you know, of course, have very keen senses of smell. So I think that a lot of people are surprised, you know, when they'll see, you know, they'll say, my goodness, you know, most dogs are very friendly, blah, 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 blah. Well, they are. But if you watch dogs closely, and I've done with this student, dogs are making a lot of an assessment as another dog or a person approaches them. You know, they're reading the body language and probably the odors. So, you know, we also do that. You know, when you see somebody running at you with their hand up in the air, you know, like as if they're going to beat you up, you know, you respond differently from if they approach you in a very light gait with a smile on their face.
Are dogs who are aggressive toward other dogs, is it often because of fear?
Yes. I think it's very often, it's sort of like what we call a defensive aggression. But, you know, once again, there are dogs who are just downright nasty, just like there are people.
I don't know if it's that I was watching a pet psychic on TV or something, but I was hearing some self-proclaimed experts say that, you know, you really can explain things to your dog. For instance, when it was time to say goodbye to Farfel, we told Lulu what was happening. We explained it to her and actually brought Farfel over and had a little group hug, let her say goodbye to him.
Sure.
Is that real? Or, I mean, we figured why not, you know, in case it was real, we'd give it a shot. But she seemed
right.
to, I don't know, what do you think?
Well, I actually think what you did is right. Do I think that, do I know if they know? I don't. But there are definitely, you know, this is where we can look to wild animals and learn about dogs. Gorillas, for example, are known to have wakes for dead animals. And there are some observations of, like in elephants and in some of the great apes, of when there is an impending death, the other animals respond differently than when the other, you know, the animal is dying with, is alive. And I think one reason might be a change in behavior or perhaps a change in odor. But I've done this a lot. I spend a lot of time talking to animals. I try to imagine what it's like for them to hear me. But I do spend a lot of time talking to them and explaining things because, while I know that they don't have the conceptual development that we do, there's really no reason not to talk to them. For example, when I've talked to dogs, you know, who are around a buddy who's dying, if nothing else, it comforts them. You know, you're talking in a low voice. You're not threatening.
You know, I've often thought it had to be tone of voice because clearly they don't understand English. But if I say in a very flat monotone, "Do you want to go for a walk?" She knows.
Yes.
Now, what's up with that?
Well, actually, I think that they do have a certain amount of vocabulary. There was a dog in Germany a couple years ago who knew 200 words, and she could go fetch a toy from another room if someone said, you know, her name was Rico. She said, "Rico, go get the ball. Rico, you know, go get the rope. Rico, go get the bone." And the fascinating thing was Rico had learned the meaning, if you will, of about 200 words. But the fascinating thing was you could ask her to go do something she had never, fetch something she had never seen before. And she could also pick that out by a phenomenon that's called exclusion learning, which is a very highly evolved trait. And so dogs know certain words. I mean, there's no doubt that your dog knew the word walk. I mean, if I were on the phone and Jethro was sleeping in front of me and I would say, "Hey, Tom, when I get off, I'm taking Jethro for a walk," Jethro would bound up and he'd be looking at me and panting like, you know, "Let's go."
Absolutely. Why do they love their walks so much?
Oh, I think they love being outdoors like we like being outdoors.
Yeah.
The odors, the smells, the visual stimuli.
And is it better for them to go on different walks all the time or the same walks so they can, as someone told me, check their P-mail?
Yeah, right. Well, I studied the pea male by scooping yellow snow and moving it around to see how Jethro would respond. I think, you know, for dogs, variety is the spice of all life as well. Jethro certainly liked the normal walk we took for every morning for 10 years. You know, I'd walk him for 2 miles in the morning and in the afternoon and sometimes in the evening. But I think he also loved it when I would switch his walk. I would do this big loop from my house. I live in the mountains. So sometimes I would go clockwise and sometimes counterclockwise. Sometimes I'd just go out and back. And I know that he loved, number one, he loved being out there, but number two, he really enjoyed the novelty. So I would try to, sometimes I'd try to take him at different times so he would meet different dogs or at least meet up with their odors of different dogs.
You love your dogs, don't you?
I love my dogs. Yes.
I know, and that's why I do this show, because it just allows me to talk about it more.
Right.
It's a departure from all the depressing things going on in the world today, you know?
Oh, yeah, and I mean, that's why I study, so I study animal emotions, is because I love what I do. I'm excited. I love sharing the knowledge, the science, the stories that people send me. But also, you know, a lot of people don't have the good fortune to get out and watch animals or can't live with dogs because they live somewhere where dogs aren't allowed or something like that. And so I think it's really important for dog lovers and animal lovers to just get out there and spread the good news about how wonderful our companions are.
Thank you so much for helping me do that today, Mark.
You bet. Thank you so much for your interest, and thank you to your listeners.
Mark Beckhoff is the author of The Emotional Lives of Animals. It is subtitled A Leading Scientist Explores Animal Joy, Sorrow, and Empathy, and Why They Matter. It's in hardback, and it's available from New World Library. I'm Joanne Green, and if you have any questions or would like to send me feedback, I would love to hear from you. Just send an email to gooddog@smarterpodcasts.com. Now go walk your dog.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.